Welcome to Soundprint. I'm Barbara Bogave. Charmaine Neville singing Mardi Gras in New Orleans from her album Queen of New Orleans. And Charmaine deserves the title as much as anyone. She's the third generation of the legendary Neville family. Her father is saxophonist Charles Neville, and her brothers are Art, Aaron, and Cyril. She started out backing the Neville Brothers Band, and then she branched out on her own in her 20s. Time magazine has called her the best pair of lungs in New Orleans. But still, like many people in her hometown, she struggles to make enough to cover the mortgage. She doesn't have a car, not much savings. And that's pretty much where she was with her life, in a small house in New Orleans' Ninth Ward, when Katrina hit. What happened after that became a Katrina horror story. On September 5th, Charmaine Neville was taped by a local TV station, and she told New Orleans Archbishop Alfred C. Hughes about 4 days she spent on the roof of a school, along with more than 20 other residents who'd fled their homes. She spoke of dead bodies in the waters, carnivorous alligators, rape and violence. Charmaine Neville became the face of the disaster in New Orleans for thousands of people who downloaded the video online and traded it on bulletin boards and websites. People asked the same question over and over on the web. How could this happen to one of the queens of New Orleans? Here's how. Our story after Katrina is produced by Mia Kim.
I was at my house when the actual storm hit. The reason I stayed for the hurricane was because I really didn't have anywhere to go. No money, no car. My neighbor wasn't going anywhere. His house was lower than mine. I had cats and dogs, and he had dogs, and our other neighbor was leaving with a car full of people, and, you know, I wanted to go, but I didn't want to leave him behind, all my pets. So I stayed, and I boarded up my house, and thought I could ride Katrina out. I thought, like a lot of other people, that it would be just another one of those storms, you know, that would knock a few trees over and maybe even blow a few roofs off, but I didn't think it was going to be as bad as it was. I guess when everything kind of started on Sunday night, when the wind started picking up, and I got a little nervous, but it wasn't bad then, you know. There was just wind, and we hadn't gotten any real rain, and it was just Sunday night. I actually was standing on the front porch watching the wind blow stuff down the street, you know, and bend a few trees every now and then, but it was kind of calm. I think I laid on the sofa in the front room and just kind of listened to the wind, and it got worse and worse and worse and worse and worse. And you could feel it moving the house and stuff, so we got up and went into the kitchen and set. That's when it really got bad. The wind started shaking the house from side to side. The water up in the street was all the way up to my front porch, and my house sits very high off the street. So it was pretty frightening to see that much water, to see that my next-door neighbor's house already had water in it. The water was above her hurricane fence, which is a good 5-6 feet, I'm going to say. And we rode that part of the storm out. I mean, the real bad stuff didn't start happening until after the storm was over. You know, the storm was terrifying. The lightning, the thunder, and the water rising, the wind breaking windows and breaking trees and shaking the house and just sounding like a train whistle, you know, going past my house. And it was very frightening. All of the windows on the left side of my house just exploded, and water was coming in that way. And water from the street was starting to come in, creep in. So we left out of the house. My neighbor went back to his house to grab some things, and I grabbed my cat, put him in a basket, and swam to the school. And we pretty much stayed in the school all that first day. And it was hot. There was no lights. I had some water and stuff in my house. The water was still working, and the water hadn't started to really rise yet. So I went with a bunch of the different guys that were at the school back and forth to different people's houses and got what we could, ice, water, food, whatever we felt like we could cook, you know, cold cuts, everything. And somebody came in a boat with a pot, a big, huge pot and a burner. And we had beans and stuff. So we went up on the roof and cooked beans. We were listening to the radio, but we never heard anybody saying, "Help is coming." buses are on the way, trucks are on the way. We never heard any of that. We saw helicopters, lots of them. They kept passing us by and passing us by. We saw them rescuing people. Some people that they were rescuing, they were bringing to Navy ships to the Navy base. And other people they were bringing to the foot of the Industrial Canal Bridge and letting them walk in water, at least up to your midriff in some cases, in other people's cases even higher up, and walk in that water all the way to the Superdome or the Convention Center or to wherever they were told that they might be able to get buses to get out of the city. Lots of people, old people, pregnant women, young kids, in water that was nasty and filthy, that they didn't give them a ride. And at night, there's no lights. We stood on the roof of that school with flashlights guiding people in the water to see where there was a light, you know, so that they could see to get. And they had just been dropped off at the foot of that bridge in pitch blackness to walk in water over fallen trees and pieces of people's houses and all kinds of cars and everything are in the street. So these people can't see any of this stuff in the nighttime. So we just shine the light to show them a beacon which way to come to. And you could hear people screaming in the night and splashing in the water and babies crying. And helicopters were steadily flying, passing by. And this went on for all those days and all those nights. We did see some, I don't know whether it was National Guards, Louisiana National Guardsmen or Reserve, whatever, you know, but they did stop once, no, twice. And that was the first time that they stopped was the very first day. A guy had had one of the elderly men had had a heart attack on the steps of the school in front of all of the kids, and it was like 100 degrees out there in that heat, and he had a heart attack. They stopped and picked him up and took him in the water and put him down in the bottom of the school in the water, and then they left. And we didn't see them anymore. And I think on the second day we did see two more. They came and removed someone else who had died. And then that was it. All we saw from that time on was them just flying over us and passing us by. Just really feeling like no one was going to help us. And hearing on the radio that water was coming in more. The only thing you kept hearing them say was, stay where you are. You're safe where you are. But were we safe? Every day we had less food from all the stuff we had salvaged from people's houses. Babies were sick and had no food, no water. Their mothers couldn't give them any. The fathers couldn't find anything to give to the mothers. Each night the mothers would go to sleep telling the babies it's going to be all right, and the next morning waking up to the same thing. And I know the fear that she had while she was telling her baby that, you know, but what could she say? Guys did go out and start to open up stores and get baby food and get shoes for people who didn't have shoes and shirts for people who had been rescued from their homes without anything on and juices and whatever they could find. They just brought anything back. So it was good. People were helping each other, you know. There were people who were breaking into stores and getting stuff that didn't mean anything, you know. And there were guys with guns, and yes, there were rapists. I know personally. But on the mass scale of what I was hearing on the radio, no. There were people doing it, but it was a minority of people in my neighborhood that were doing that, a minority. And they weren't people that were from my neighborhood. They came in from other areas, you know, to take advantage. But it was a small minority. It wasn't everybody. Like we were hearing on the radio that everybody in New Orleans was toting guns and shooting up and breaking into windows and stealing TVs and sofas. And what are you going to do with a TV and you have no power? What are you going to do with a sofa? If you get it to your house and your house is underwater, what good is that going to do you? Not only do the looters take advantage of destroying, you know, what people should be able to come back to, but also the people that in the midst of the disaster are charging people exorbitant prices for things like gas and food and water, you know, instead of being nice enough to hand out. So, you know, because there was some of that going on too, you know. Weren't they looters as well, taking from people, you know? So I don't get with the people that were taking televisions and things and people's furniture. I don't understand that. But the people that took loaves of bread and baby food and bottles of milk and water and toilet paper and wet wipes and diapers, tennis shoes, shirts, yeah, we had to survive. Whatever you could get your hands on, you took it. It didn't matter what it was to drink, it was something wet, you know, so you got whatever you could get. Nobody was coming to help us. Didn't matter how many times we waved flags and we were hearing on the radio, tie something white outside. We had written help signs. We had white sheets, pillowcases, guys' T-shirts, everything. And we're flying things and nobody ever paid attention to us. Flashlights doing SOS kind of, you know. Nobody ever stopped. All the waving and the signs and the jumping and the hollering and didn't work. So there were guys, they weren't on our school roof that were shooting. We had heard shooting in the school across the street, and there were some guys in the street with guns. And yes, they were shooting in the air and said, well, maybe we'll make them hear this. And unbeknownst to us, you can't hear anything in a helicopter, you know. I mean, the blades, the noise from the blades alone. But yeah, it was like, yeah, shoot, get their attention, you know. They weren't shooting at the helicopters that I could see. On the last day, it just got to the point where we really felt like we weren't going to be rescued on that fifth day. And we made a plan to get out. And a guy who had had a flatboat who had been going all through the neighborhood rescuing people. And I know he had some kind of military background because he was just so in charge. You know, he wasn't shaky or nervous, or and he really thought help was coming. And another military man was with him, and also his uncle, his aunt, another one of his aunts who was in a wheelchair with no legs, his mother, his father, and two neighbors from across the street from their house, and two other people that we just saw walking in the water. And we all got in this flatboat, plus two dogs and my cat and a picnic basket. All got into the boat and went to where the water was the lowest and stood in the water and waited while he took the boat back to his house and put it in his yard and locked the yard, like, you know. And we started walking in the water. I mean, you know, in some places it was so deep that you were scared. In other places it was low, you know. And we got to the highest part of the, like, towards the river. And there was no water there, so we were able to walk through that. We had already seen fish bigger than me, alligators, stuff floating in the water that I don't even want to talk about, things from people's homes, roofs, trees, dead animals, grease and oil and muck, dead people, you know, cars floating, parts of whole houses just floating, sitting in the middle of the street. The alligator, I mean, for as nasty as the water was, I was surprised the alligators were surviving, you know. But they were eating folks, and one man, his whole leg was just chewed off by one. Just chewed off. And, but still there were lots of people sitting up on their galleries, you know, hollering down to you, I got something cold to drink, you want something? We got some sweet rolls. You want us to come down and get y'all some sweet rolls, some potato chips? They were barbecuing on, you know, getting all of the meat out of their freezer so it wouldn't turn rotten. And they were cooking everything, and just whoever passed by, they would give to. We walked to the French Quarters because we heard there was a telephone there. And there was a guy driving a bus all the way around in the Ninth Ward, picking up anybody and everybody and just bringing them to the French Quarters, because he heard that there were buses down there to help people. And we saw him, you know, but we couldn't put the boat on the bus, so we kept walking. And I kept pushing this guy's mother in the wheelchair. And it was hot. We were thirsty. We were sick from the water. There was no restrooms. There, you know, it was just nasty. It was horrible. By the time we got to the French Market, we found the phones that they said were working. And the phones were working, but only to take your money. You couldn't get a call through. And we walked up to Canal Street, and I saw the whole street of Canal from where the water started all the way down to where it was high and dry by the Harris Casino. I saw TV camera trucks and news people. And a friend of ours had gotten separated from us, so we had to walk from the foot of Canal to, like, almost to the Rampart Street to find her. And as we went closer to Rampart, of course, the water started getting higher. I had an elderly man with me, and I asked one of the reporters who I saw drinking a cold, cold bottle of water if she could give a bottle of water to him, and she told me, no, we need this. And I said, what y'all need to do is be down there in the area where stuff is really going on, where people are dying, you know. But y'all are down here taking pictures of the buildings on Canal Street. And that's when I saw a reporter. I didn't know who he was. I just grabbed him and told him to turn his camera on, and I told him, look, we need help. We need somebody to get in here and help us. People are dying. Babies are dead. Old people are dead. People are starving and dying of dehydration. People don't have their medication. There's lots of people trapped in hospices. And I told him of the rapes and of everything. And then I just walked away and went to find my friend. And we got back, after we found her, we went back to where the police were at Harris Casino. And I tried to talk to him about helping me get all of these people. You know, we had been together and our numbers had grown by this time to help us. And they said, get all of your people and we'll help you. And so we had to go all the way back to the French Market to get the people. And that's when I saw the bus and the young man driving it. We all got on the bus, drove down to Canal Street. He took his family and he went to the convention center. And we all went over to the casino where the police were. And the trucks with all of the guys in uniforms on it were pulling out. And I asked, why are they leaving? They say more water is coming. So we were scared even more so. More water, you know? And I hadn't even gone around the corner yet to see the masses of people that were at the convention center. I had not seen that yet. The policemen told me that there was nothing they could do for us. And I saw the trucks pulling out. The guys on the trucks wouldn't even look at us. And the bus was sitting in the middle of Canal Street. And I told all of the people, get on the bus. Just get on the bus. We're going to get out. We got on the bus, and going by the convention center, we picked up the young man who had been driving the bus in the first place and his family. And so many people were trying to get on this one bus. One bus. We didn't even know how much gas we had or anything. We just started driving. And we drove up the ramp, like right by the convention center off Chapatula Street. And as we were going up, a police car tried to cut us off to keep us from going across the bridge. We saw them ushering other people down, back down the bridge. They wouldn't let them walk across. We saw another police car come and almost try to cut us off, but wasn't going to stop. And they had their guns and stuff out. They weren't New Orleans police officers. I don't know who they were, but they were not New Orleans police officers. And we just pedaled to the metal and drove and drove and drove. For a while, I thought we were lost, but one of the guys, the military guys, had a GPS, and we kind of found our way to some little town. I don't know the name of the town, but I do know that the police officers and the ambulance workers that came and took care of those old people on the bus, I one day want to be able to go back and tell them thank you, you know, because they really helped us. And they pointed us into the direction of Donaldsonville and told us there was a church there and that the people would help us. And we went to Donaldsonville, and from Donaldsonville, I was able to get in touch with my best friend in the whole world, Wendy. And she called somebody who called somebody else who called somebody else. And, you know, through all of it, I had cried some. I was sick some, but I had always tried to, you know, just be up. But when I heard my friend's voice on that phone, I just lost it, and I couldn't hold it together anymore. And to think that the whole time she had been looking for me, because I kept thinking to myself all those days that I was up there, nobody even is looking for me. Nobody's looking for me. And these people, I'm invisible to them. They're not going to stop. They're not going to help us. We're all going to die. But I wouldn't say that to anybody else, but that was what I was feeling. One of the days in the school, I did break down. I was so scared. It was after someone had had a heart attack, and I saw them come and just put the body in the water and then drive off and leave us. And they said on the radio more water was coming, and I was really, really scared and just broke down crying. But I realized I had to hold it together. I got to go back after the first storm, and the water had gone down in my neighborhood, and I felt like I was in a Twilight Zone episode. There was nobody around. It was absolutely quiet. The only thing you could hear was people's houses where their fire alarms, the batteries were starting to die, and you could hear them doing that last beep, beep, beep. You know, you looked out over all of those empty houses and know that in each one of those houses, there had been families who had lives, who had jobs, who had, you know, things to do. And all of that was gone. All of it. As far as you could see, there was nothing. There wasn't any birds. The grass and trees and everything was gray. It was like New Orleans was in black and white. You know, there was no color, just a gray, kind of dead. And I got to my house, and my house was standing, and a few other houses back there that looked great, you know. And I felt really guilty that my house was standing, and when I turned my head and looked the other way, all of those houses were going to be gone. Just gone. When I escaped from Katrina, I've been to so many different people's houses. I can't even tell you how many people, but I can tell you that all of them have been nice, and all of them have taken me in. And whether I spent one night there or a week there, you know, I've been made to feel like I was a family member. People have been really giving, you know. Americans have really stepped forward and helped and taken people in. You know, it's like somebody threw a ball into a bucket of water and all the drops splashed and went in different parts of the country. Every place that people have gone, I've heard nothing but great reports that people have been taken in and been given almost Southern hospitality, you know. So we've rubbed off on people, and that's a good feeling. We've been invisible for so long. We've been invisible living in our cities and going about our everyday lives and trying to survive. And once again, we were shown to be invisible on a really large, grand scale. We were shown that invisibility was still there. See, what they were showing on television was just black faces. They were not showing them the Asian people, the Hispanic people, the German people, the Irish people, the, you know, Brazilians, or the Haitians, or the Africans, you know. They weren't showing them what New Orleans was really about. What they wanted to show was, over and over, someone told me they kept seeing the same clip of a few guys with guns. They kept showing that over and over, making people think that that's what everybody in New Orleans was doing, and that we stayed there because we wanted to gain control of the city and be looters and be thieves, and we were all on drugs and we were all members of gangs. The people of my city were all wonderful people. The little man who rode people around in his buggy in the French quarters. The kids that stood on the corner and either tap danced or told you, "I know where you got those shoes from. I bet you I can tell you." The lady who put the sugar on your beignets at the Café Du Monde. The city is made up of a lot of different people, the hotel workers, the taxi drivers, the police officers on their bikes and horses, you know, the executives that catch the bus anyway, the rich, the not so rich, the homeless. There were a lot of people in that city, and that's what made the city what it was. we're going back. I have every intention of going back and rebuilding not just my house, but my neighborhood. People used to ask me, why did I stay in that neighborhood? And my response to them was always, this is my neighborhood. If I leave my neighborhood, what am I showing the kids and young people that are coming behind me? Get something and take it away from your neighborhood? No, you stay in your neighborhood and you give back, because those are the people you got it from, you know? And it's all going to happen again, all of it. New Orleans will be back to the great and rich city that she was. And when I say rich, I mean rich in people, you know, and prosperity for all of her people, not just some of her people. And we'll be back. The music will flow. The red beans will smell up the street, you know. And you'll hear the kids laughing and the dogs barking. And you'll be invited to come and partake in that with us, you know, from Jazz Fest to Mardi Gras, or to just a plain old ordinary jazz funeral, you know. Because that's an everyday thing to us, so it's ordinary, you know. Everybody gets a jazz funeral. I miss New Orleans right now. I miss it with all my heart. It doesn't matter where I went in the world, it was always good to go home, always. And I always bragged about my city, my Saints, you know, my Hornets, about everything, my Zephyrs. One day, you know. And as long as everybody doesn't forget, that's the thing, because if it happened in New Orleans on such a massive scale, it can happen anywhere, anywhere in the world.
After Katrina, Charmaine Neville's story was produced by Mia Kim. Charmaine's currently living in Laplace, Louisiana, while she works to rebuild her New Orleans home. All of the music you heard in this program was performed by the Charmaine Neville Band and is available on their albums Up, Up, Up and It's About Time. And you can find links to those albums on our website. And you can also listen to the show again just by logging on to soundprint.org. Support for Soundprint comes from ToadNet, a provider of business and residential DSL throughout the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. Information about ToadNet services can be found on their website. That's www.toad.net or by calling 877-GET-TOAD. On the next Soundprint, what color is your name?
The word C is raspberry, yellow, and crimson. My alphabet is beautiful with lots of hot reds and purples.
Short Circuit. Next time on Soundprint. And here's the toll-free number to call for CD dubs of Soundprint. 1-888-38-TAPES. That's 1-888-38-TAPES. Soundprint is produced by the Soundprint Media Center in association with WAMU and American University. You can always reach us best via email. Here it is, talkback@soundprint.org. That's one word, talkback@soundprint.org. Soundprint is technical director Anna Maria DeFreitas, associate producer Katie Gott, and sound engineer Jared Weisbrot. Our executive producer is Moira Rankin. I'm Barbara Bogave.